Good morning and happy New Year's Eve, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And Robert Knott will be with us in just a little while. Speaking of the arts, I'm going to re-air today a segment about the film American Casino. It's a film that screened in Santa Fe a while back and has just recently come out on DVD. You can find out more about it at AmericanCasinoTheMovie.com. I'm delighted now to welcome Andrew Coburn. He is co-producer of the film American Casino. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
So this film explains, really as clearly as anything I've encountered, the Wall Street mortgage debacle. You use the gambling metaphor in the title and in the film. Who was gambling with whose money?
Basically, Wall Street and the, by extension, the international financial community, I mean investors globally, were gambling. They were gambling, certainly, and as it turned out, they were gambling with our money. Well, first of all, they were gambling with people's houses. People were being induced into, or persuaded, put it politely, into loans, which loans were then quickly became chips in the great casino of Wall Street and the world. As it turned out, in the end, of course, when all those bets went bad, they helped themselves to our money, which is why we have we talk about a $12 trillion bailout in the film.
Let's go back to 2000 and Senator Phil Graham. He sponsored a bill that excluded from federal and state regulation basically the whole financial industry, if I understood the film right. Why did he do it, and why did people buy into this?
Well, he did it. I mean, what he specifically, particularly, I mean, there was a whole, you got it right. I mean, he did, in effect, it let the financial industry off the hook. The particular thing that caused, really sowed the seeds of total disaster, was a kind of betting called credit default swaps, which had been banned back, in the Depression time, in a sense, and then sort of were growing. They wanted to legalize them again and prevent. The bill said that states couldn't ban these credit default swaps under the gambling laws that a lot of states have. It sort of like excluded them from federal and local state regulation. And that was because then Wall Street felt it had no risk. It could take your mortgage and sell it on, divide it up, slice and dice it. If you're not with you, but with someone had a mortgage, a loan that they probably weren't going to be able to pay, they could get a ratings agency to say it was a good security and then sell it on to a Korean bank or whatever. And then they could take a bet or make a bet on whether it would be paid off or not. So they felt they were totally hedged. It threw the casino right open sesame 24/7.
So they could really bet either way. They could bet that you would pay your loan, or somebody else could bet on the other side that you weren't going to pay it. And either way, whatever happened, somebody would make money.
Absolutely. I mean, what they thought was that they not only would they make lots of money, which for a while they certainly did, but they couldn't lose money, which, as they've discovered the hard way in the last year or so, turned out not to be the case. They could lose a lot of money, but as we say in the film, it wasn't too bad for them after all, because we've bailed them out, we the taxpayer.
Right, and we'll talk in a few minutes about the people who are not being bailed out. But just to understand this whole question of risk a little bit more, it was Alan Greenspan's ideology, as explained in the film, that it was a good thing to move risk from mortgage lending banks. So, I'm a bank. I give a mortgage, basically, which says that somebody who bought a house is going to pay me back. So they were no longer really taking the risk, and that made them incredibly cocky, and they truly didn't care if anybody paid or not, because it was no longer their problem.
That's right. I mean, that's the most, in a way, one of the most astonishing things we discovered in making American Casino. I'm glad you pick up on that, because it's a very important fact to understand about this whole disaster, is the banks didn't care whether the people taking out mortgages would pay or not, because, as you said, they thought they'd spread the risk. So that's why, you know, they were happy to push loans on people who, if they thought about it and, you know, and actually explained it honestly to the borrowers, you know, everyone would have known they couldn't pay the loan off.
Part of the promise of financial deregulation in general was a kind of a trickle-down argument that consumers would somewhere along the line save money. Did that happen?
No. I mean, consumers lost an enormous amount of money. I mean, consumers were persuaded as part of this whole casino that, you know, because you can join in too, because the price of houses, like your house, always goes up. You take out a loan. I mean, one stray figure. Let's say you take out you'll sell the subprime loan at 8%, which was by no means the highest end. I mean, one of the characters in our film, one of the people we come to know in the film, Denzel Mitchell, he was paying almost 12%, and someone else was paying 12%. But let's say you had to take out a $165,000 loan at 8%. Well, the rule of thumb for the industry was that would yield, over the course of the loan, $100,000 extra. So this person was paying $265,000 by the time they'd paid all the interest, assume they could manage to keep paying it, on a $165,000 loan. Furthermore, people were encouraged to take money out of their houses. One of the three people, borrowers, we follow in the film, Reverend Almeline Wade, who is now homeless, a minister in Baltimore, she owned her house free and clear. She wasn't taking out a loan, you know, to get a house she shouldn't, you know, didn't deserve to have or couldn't afford, which is like the mantra that's, you know, often said about these people. She owned her little house. She'd inherited it from her parents. But she wanted to make some home improvements, and she was persuaded, or, you know, someone told her it was a good idea to take out a loan on the house to do that. You know, she was not someone aspiring to, you know, live beyond her station, far from it. So no, people were persuaded to join in the casino, but they certainly lost.
Now, one point, as we've just talked about, was that the banks didn't care if the loans were paid back or not. Also, a lot of people along the way, all sorts of middlemen along the so-called value chain, a lot of these terms are not terms I'm very familiar with, but people along the value chain were getting paid. And so there was all sorts of money going to essentially paper pushers.
That's right. I mean, the reason, of course, none of us had heard phrases like value chain before, but the reason you can use it now is because someone in the film talks about it, and that's, we were keen to have people in the film who were insiders. I mean, we have a banker in the film, and we chose him and persuaded him to talk because he talked the way they talk to each other, and that was the important. You know, anyway, yes, you're absolutely right. People along the value chain, from the loan officer at the mortgage, you know, lending outfit, who's persuading some inner city person in Baltimore who's, you know, never taken out a mortgage before to take a loan and is telling them that, oh, it's great for you to pay 8% or 10% because you can refinance in 6 months or a year or 2 years, and meanwhile the price of your house will have gone up. That person was making extra points, 3, 4, 5 points on the mortgage. Right up then, the next level up, the mortgage lending company then would sell loans to the banks, and the banks were so eager to buy these loans that they would pay 105%. There'll be thousands of them bundled together, but say it was a $100,000 loan, they would pay $105,000 for it because with the interest calculated on, you know, it was still an attractive proposition. So the banks would then rake off a fee and securitize it, lovely words, and they would bundle the loans that they bought from one mortgage lender with lots of loans from another until they had this giant package, and then they'd sell that on, you know, slice it up and sell off the slices, taking a hefty fee for themselves along the way. The ratings company would rate what might be, if you looked at them closely, you know, rather very risky-looking, you know, mortgages, and they would obligingly rate them AAA for a hefty fee from the bank, and then these bonds would be then sliced up again, and someone else would take a fee, and so on and so forth. So everyone was taking their money up front. That's why they didn't care.
Right.
Certainly stopped thinking about whether you or I, whoever had they'd sold the mortgage to in the first place, was going to be able to pay it.
We're talking to Andrew Coburn, co-producer of the film American Casino. One of the really heartbreaking things about the film is that it divides pretty much along racial lines. The people who are winning all this money were white men. The people who were losing were black families. And the practice of actually giving these loans that went bad was called in the film, and this is another fascinating term, reverse redlining. Explain that.
Okay, yes, it is one of the most horrifying features, and we became aware of it when we were making American Casino. Previously, you had minority communities, and we focus on, in the film, on the city of Baltimore, the inner city of Baltimore, with a predominantly African-American population, but it also, to a certain extent, applied to Hispanics and other minorities elsewhere, but particularly African-Americans, was for years, they'd been redlined. The banks wouldn't give them credit. There were literally maps with red lines drawn around minority African-American areas. But then they discovered, due to a couple of developments in the technology of mortgage lending, such as rating people by their credit scores, once you have access to someone's credit score, the lenders and the banks figured that they could then calculate absolutely with mathematical certainty, without looking at someone's particular circumstance, whether they have a job or not, just look at their credit score. We know if they're going to be able to be good for this loan, or at least good for this loan for a while. So they started to make, if we charge them enough interest, so they started to make high interest loans, subprime loans, inside what had been the redlined areas. And that's why the term reverse redlining, I think, was coined or certainly used by a very great civil rights lawyer who appears in the film, John Relman, who is now acting on behalf of the city of Baltimore. But isn't it sort of ironic that having been suffered for years from being redlined, now we have a usually if something's reversed, it means if something was bad in the first place and you reverse it, that means it's getting better. But here was something that was bad in the first place, and they reversed it and made it worse.
And I think there's so much to be said about that. I mean, we've talked on this program at different times about how food is more expensive in poor neighborhoods and it's harder to get good quality food. But loans are also more expensive. You'd think that they'd give a break to the people who can least afford it, but it's really the opposite. And I think that, something you do in the film that's very important is seeing this whole phenomenon as a continuity from slavery through Jim Crow and redlining. And the net effect of this has been to make a lot of black people not homeowners, but actually homeless or with larger debts than they ever had before, or destroyed credit ratings with their possessions on the curb of the street.
That, I'm afraid to say, is horribly true. It's actually been a huge drain of equity out of black communities, out of poor communities. In the financial meltdown, a lot of people have lost money, but it's really shocking and ironic that the people who've always been on the short end have lost even more. There was a great article, op-ed piece in the New York Times by Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dimed, and Diedrich Mohammed, who's been working very hard on this issue. He's an analyst here in Washington. And they pointed out that they say the recession for black men actually ended in about 2005. Since then, there's been a depression, from recession to depression.
Right.
Because, for this, among other reasons. Yes, of course, the whole financial crisis has been, bad for everyone, bar some of the bankers who started it all in the first place, who've now been bailed out. I don't want to sort of minimize, just say we should only feel sorry about minorities and black people and so forth, but it is a shocking and horrifying fact that they have suffered more than anyone because they were targeted.
And I think the word targeted, there's so many inadvertent metaphors that come up in these things when you're talking about securitizing and bundles and slicing and packages and all these things this language that they use. But, target, they are taking aim at these vulnerable people and actually lying to them, telling them that their payment was going to be one amount and it turns out to be another amount. They were charging them higher interest rates that everybody else in the world was paying and everybody else in the country was paying. They were even – loan officers were even making up income figures. So if somebody was making $2,000 a month, they would write on the form purposely $2,000 a week so that they would qualify for a loan that they couldn't qualify for. And what I wanted to ask you about this was, were there – activists? Were there people in the neighborhoods who started to get savvy to this? Was there a movement before the actual meltdown?
Yes, there were. You know, there were activists. I mean, there's there were activists in New Mexico, which is one of the reasons why New Mexico hasn't suffered as much as other states, because there's actually quite a, you know, Governor Richardson, when he was there, signed quite a good anti-subprime law. Yes, you know, there were. The Center, but nationally, the Center for Responsible Lending, a whole bunch of groups were agitating about this, and it wasn't just activist groups. There was a governor of the Federal Reserve, the late Mr. Gramlich. You know, he was going into seeing Alan Greenspan, saying we're headed for disaster here. But you know, Alan Greenspan and the high command of the financial industry and their, you know, their handmaidens in Washington just were, you know, so mesmerized by the enormous amounts of money they were making, or thought they were making, that they paid no attention. I mean, it was clear as daylight that if you went on, that the people, you know, on a income X couldn't possibly go on affording interest payments Y. You know, that was the long and the short of it. And especially not if you had a practice which, as a former mortgage salesman who's in our film, Bill O'Malley, you know, he says blithely, talking about what you just mentioned, about making up people's income, he said almost everyone in the industry was doing it. You know, it was absolutely standard. He says that when he's standing in what's now an empty office building, where in the room he's standing there were like 50 people working away, all making what they were called stated loans, you know, making up figures.
It really does point to the dangers. I mean, I think everybody on the planet is vulnerable to this. When you're in a situation where everybody's doing something, that becomes the culture, and it's very easy not to stand up to it, even if half or all of the people know that it's wrong.
Well, that's true. And in fact, there's an argument that, hey, we shouldn't really blame these banks because, you know, if you're running a big bank and everyone else is doing it, how are you going to justify not doing it to your stockholders? But actually, the people who saw not only what we were headed for disaster, but acted on it. Some people, whether you think it's a good thing or not, made a huge amount of money. I mean, there's a character in our film, Jeff Green, who was a real estate investor in California, and he just, as he says in the film, he says in early 2006, he heard that only 12% of the people in California could afford the median-priced California home. And he thought, well, if only 12% can afford the house, obviously not many people are going to be buying houses, and therefore the prices of houses will have to fall. I mean, ABC. And he bet $1 billion. I mean, he did some, you know, did more research than that, but he basically bet $1 billion on that notion. And when we did the interview, he'd made $500 million off that bet, and I think he's made a lot more sense. So people, you know, you didn't have to go along. Yes, there were people, you know, around the country for good reasons and for venal reasons. Anyway, people who saw what was coming and tried to stop it, but sadly, except in a few cases, they were not successful.
We're talking to Andrew Coburn, co-producer of the film American Casino. It also made me think, I mean, there are people who have argued, well, you know, they signed these papers on a mortgage they couldn't afford. It's their own fault. Nobody understands what they're signing. I bought a house many years ago. I had no idea what I was signing. I had to completely trust the mortgage company and my real estate broker. And it just reminds you how much of lending and banking is based on trust. And here you have a case where that trust was just bald-facedly violated.
Yeah. I mean, you got it in one. Actually, you know, credit comes from the Latin word meaning I believe.
Right.
It's exactly that. People, you know, people trusted their mortgage broker, and actually they had little option when the documents they were asked to sign, you know, was the size of a phone book. And furthermore, as Robert Strupp, who appears in the film, who's now a community lawyer in Baltimore but used to be in the mortgage lending industry, he said, oh, yeah, it was all carefully organized so that people would be, you know, be the end of the day and they had to go get their kid from daycare or whatever, and they were signing documents on the hood of a car.
Right.
I mean, how could you possibly giver considered, and not only you didn't understand the document, I mean, lawyers, we talked to a lot of professionals, they said, oh, we don't understand these things. So, you know, how could someone who's maybe very good at the job they're doing, but then didn't take a course in real estate law in case they wanted to buy a house, you know, and even if they had, they probably wouldn't have understood it because it was all carefully arranged, so you did not understand it. It really is, you know, I don't want to sound flippant or anything, but this is one of the most, collectively, the most gigantic fraud in history, I think, that was done. I mean, we could go on for several more hours talking about the ramifications of it, but yes, that's what it was.
And people can see the film, and they should see the film, because despite everything, it's a wonderful film to watch. You guys are terrific filmmakers, and it's very well made with excellent cinematography. But besides the money sucked out of poor communities, along with people's equity, what you have then is the community around it collapsing with all the attendant problems of crime and drugs and illness and mental illness and squatting and meth houses and things like that, and all sorts of public resources. When you talk about the drain, so many more public resources, police and fire, and even you have a scene with these people checking the water in abandoned swimming pools for larvae of mosquitoes that might have West Nile virus. I mean, it just goes, the chain effect goes on and on.
I know. I mean, yeah, even I don't think even the greedy bankers sitting on Wall Street quite realized they were going to be responsible for spreading West Nile virus in California.
I
but
know.
That is what happened. I mean, you know, as you describe the scene, it's, you know, in the swimming pools of Riverside County, eastern Riverside County, outside east of Los Angeles, practically out in the desert, and people, you know, foreclosures by the thousand. People leave, the pool pump is off, the pool gets stagnant, mosquitoes breed, and, you know, West Nile and equine encephalitis, which is worse, are there. But, yeah, I mean, it's the chain. I mean, this is, you know, when this first started to, we started going over a cliff. Mr. Bernanke, Chairman Bernanke of the Federal Reserve, he said, he was all cocky, and he said, the subprime problem can be contained. And then he went on later, he said, well, he didn't think the housing's, you know, slide in housing was going to affect the wider economy. Now he says, of course, the recession's over and we're all doing fine. So with his record of prediction, I'm not feeling too reassured. But yes, I mean, this is, it's not just a person losing their house, sad though that might be. If someone loses their house, then the bank takes it back, and then the bank sells it because they want to sell it quickly, so they knock off 40% or a discount off the price, which immediately crashes the price of every other house in the neighborhood. And then, you know, it's a vicious circle. And, you know, then, as we've been discussing, it's on to the mosquitoes and the meth gangs and the grow houses and all the rest.
Let's talk about the bailout. It seems like, again, from a regular person's perspective, somebody who doesn't understand the details of high finance, that it would have made more sense to bail out the homeowners and rewrite their mortgages to be fair, both in terms of justice and in economics. That didn't happen. What was the actual nature of the bailout? Who got the money and what did they do with it?
Well, the bank, it's very simple. The banks got the money. They've gotten so far around $4 trillion. And that we are committed to giving them, you know, if and when they want it, which they certainly will, another $8 trillion, or just around $8 trillion. So I mean, these are staggering sums of money. I mean, a billion sounds like almost small change. That's $1,000 million, and $1 trillion is $1,000,000 million. I mean, these are unbelievable sums. And what did they do with it? Well, actually, as it turns out, the whole idea was, they would take this money and start lending it to you and me to go start a business or to help lubricate the economy. But they haven't actually been doing that. The amount of bank lending has been going steadily down. They lend it to, well, now we've got a spurt. They're lending it to big corporations to buy other corporations. You know, they're getting a lot of the money they're getting, either they get it directly in the form of a gift, or which they may or may not pay back, or they're getting it in forms of credit guarantee. If you're a bank now, you basically have free money because they can borrow money at effectively 0% and lend it out to a corporation or to anyone who they do decide they can lend money to at 6, 7, 8%. I have heard cases of a big corporation that was in bankruptcy but, you know, was being kept going and being reorganized. And the bank said, fine, we'll lend you the money to keep going at 17%. So it's a good, very good time to be a banker. bankers are paying themselves the same overall level of bonuses that they were 2 years ago when the bubble was at its height.
So they're taking taxpayer money, which they get for no interest, and then turning around and charging taxpayers' interests to lend it to them. That's not fair.
Well, it's not fair. It's just not right. And everyone knows it's not right. You know, it's just, I think sooner or later, you know, something's going to pop and people are going to say, enough.
Now, did bailing out the banks, in your view, prevent another Great Depression?
Well, it may have done, but it's like when you're, you get a hurricane or a tornado goes over your house and the roof starts to fall down and you quickly sort of prop the roof from falling in and crushing you with a sort of, you know, go and get out and chop down a tree and stick it up. I mean, it was a very rickety and long-term unsustainable way of staving off a complete collapse. What was happening just over a year ago after the Lehman Brothers went bankrupt was that the money market funds, which, you know, a lot of people put their money into, they had invested a lot of money in Lehman Brothers, which had suddenly disappeared. But it turned out, which came as big news, I might say, to the Secretary of the Treasury, because he'd never actually made anything or worked in a corporation that actually did something useful. It turned out that the money market funds are the main financiers of commercial paper, which is what corporations use to fund their day-to-day activities. So suddenly, you know, corporations like, I don't know, General Electric, I mean, I'm not being specific, but, you know, big corporations suddenly found they couldn't get the money to meet the payroll, or it looked like that was what was going to happen. So that's why the sort of, that was the real panic just over a year ago.
So I came home after watching the film and looked on the Huffington Post, where I saw three things. First of all, not only do we still not have any regulation put in place after the big mortgage debacle, but the bailed out banks are still making billions of dollars off of these same exact kind of derivative loans, and they're doing it even more than they were doing it a year ago. Second, Sarah Palin, who I shouldn't even bring into the discussion, but anyway, she blames the financial crisis on too much regulation with, as Krugman put it, not a single fact to back her up. And three, that Alan Greenspan is now endorsing Obama's proposed financial reforms. Has anybody but Greenspan learned anything at all?
I think they've learned that they can get away with just about anything. Sarah Palin is she made a speech, we don't know how much for, but for a lot of money, to a financial group in Hong Kong the other day. Imagine getting Sarah Palin to come and lecture you on finance. You know, it's a, yes, some people have learned money. I mean, learned something out of all this because, you know, the savings rate in this country is shooting up from effectively zero. It's approaching, I think it's over 5% now. So people are getting smart that they not being suckered into, you know, overspending on credit cards. I mean, people, it's good. Why should, you know, the American consumer, I mean, we used to be citizens, now we're consumers. Why should we, you know, get ourselves hopelessly into debt in order to sort of keep the financial system as currently designed operating, which is the way it's worked? So it's good. I think it's very good that people are now, you know, trying to pay off their credit cards. Credit card applications, I just saw the other day, are down 30% from a year ago. I mean, new credit card applications. So that's it. You know, that system, the system that was used to, you know, to get us to get into debt, make us get into debt in order to finance, you know, Wall Street, among other things, is breaking down. I think that's a good thing. I wish Congress had learned something instead of just, you know, futzing around, which is what they're doing about regulation. And, you know, Sarah Palin's an idiot, but, you know, the problem was not enough regulation, but, I mean, they didn't even bother enforcing the regulations we did have. And I'd prefer to call it law enforcement.
Right.
Regulation is kind of a wussy word. But Congress, you know, is not tightening up. They're letting the Federal Reserve is fighting to get more power to regulate the financial system when they, you know, made such a mess with the power they did have. You know, that's the frightening thing. Not really very much is being done, except by the American people who are trying to, you know, opting out as best they can.
We're talking to Andrew Coburn. His new film is called American Casino. Has this film been widely received? Are a lot of people seeing it? It seems awfully important that they should.
Yes, it's getting seen around the country, and also it's getting widely written about. I mean, David Denby in the New Yorker magazine has written very extensively about us. The New York Times, New York Magazine.
I loved how David Denby said getting banks to rate their own bonds was approximately like getting the Russian mafia to ask the Colombian drug cartels to certify their own business.
That's right. It's exactly. I love that too. I mean, of course, the sums of money involved are bigger. The other thing I liked was in the New York Times. New York Times op-ed said, "Watching The Wire is like watching American Casino is like watching another season of The Wire, except the people, the people on the casualties are on the streets, but the people behind it are sitting behind computers in Wall Street."
Any guilt or remorse or attempt to make amends on the part of the people on Wall Street?
No, I wouldn't say. I mean, with the people who... No, I mean, I can't say I have remorse. I've yet to meet someone who says, "I realize I did a bad thing." I mean, a lot with the people we dealt with, people, very smart people from Wall Street who were very clear-eyed about it. And are very clear-eyed about the fraud of the whole securitization system. I can't say they've spent a lot of time. Although, no, I'm going to take that back. I think now I come to think about it, yes, a lot of, when we showed it, the film opened at the Tribeca Festival in New York in the spring, and a lot of Wall Street people, especially young Wall Street people, came to the screenings. Some of our screenings were in the middle of the day, and we were thinking, the filmmaker here is my wife, Leslie, who is a great director and has made many, many documentaries for CBS and ABC and PBS Frontline. But anyway, we were thinking, oh, God, who's going to come to a screening at 1 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon? And the place was crammed with Wall Streeters, and they were very moved. Seeing the effects of, on ordinary people, the people we show in Baltimore and elsewhere, the effects of what happened. It did have a big effect. So I would say, yes, there has been a certain amount of remorse. Not from all these guys who are getting the $100 million bonuses, the guys running the banks at the top. I don't think, I think they're kind of brain dead in this respect.
Andrew Coburn is co-producer of the film American Casino. Thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hey, thank you.
And once again, if you want to see this film, you can go to the website AmericanCasinoTheMovie.com. You can read about the film, and you can buy a copy of the DVD there. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back, and Robert Knott will be with us. I'd like now to welcome Robert Knott. He's the associate editor of the Pasatiempo Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe, New Mexican.
I'm running the joint.
You're running the joint. And he's the education reporter for the Santa Fe, New Mexican. He's with us every week. Speaking of the arts, should we say speaking of the arts and education?
Well, we'll say speaking of the arts this week because education is closed down, being it's still the holiday time.
Oh, right. Everyone's having a two-week-long snow day.
And I'm usually on Friday mornings, but here I am on a Thursday morning to wish everybody a happy New Year's Eve.
That's right.
And a safe New Year's Eve. So listen up. AA New Mexico Tipsy Toe. From 6 tonight until, I think, midnight tomorrow, AAA New Mexico will give you a free tow and ride home, straight home, if you are unable to drink and drive. Pardon me, if you're just unable to drive.
Home, straight home, meaning you can't stop at Walgreens for aspirin.
Or at another bar.
Right.
1-800-422-4357. But if it's more than 10 miles, there may be towing fees. Like I say, it's a free tow and ride. I believe they will take you and your car.
Oh, they'll tow your car
home. I believe. If I'm wrong, call them up. AAA. Another thing is Santa Fe County and Capital Cab always team up to help out from about 5:30 tonight until like 2 or 3 in the morning.
Now, are they encouraging drunken driving?
No, that's what people think, but I think I have to agree with Rob DeWalt's column last Friday that this is the case. People do tend to go out on New Year's Eve, and they might be responsible people and they get drunk. It's not encouraging that. It's just saying, if you're going to get drunk, please don't drive home. You know the deal. Don't do it. After that accident this past summer, no one can afford to do it. And I know it's scary. You have three drinks, you get scared. You're going to get pulled over. Don't do it. For $5, Santa Fe County and Capital City Cab can get you home to your front door from any bar or restaurant within the Santa Fe city limits.
I bet the wait for a tow is going to be really long.
It's very possible. So here we go. Call for the Capital Cab, Santa Fe County, 995-9528, or if that number's not working, try 438-0000 and mention Caddy Cab, Santa Fe County and DWI Caddy Program. There's also AAA New Mexico. Look at last week's Pasa Tiempo. Rob DeWalt Soundwaves has all the information. Nice job, because it is New Year's Eve, and you do want to maybe go out and hear some music and have some fun and be careful. So, dun-dun-dun. Pop Gallery's closing reception on Love, 6 to 9 p.m. tonight. Exhibit and food collection through Friday, and they are going to benefit all proceeds Bienvenidos Outreach. That's tonight on Water Street. Also, the Santa Fe Concert Association is teaming up with pianist Andrew Van Oyen at 5 p.m. tonight at the Lenzic. Joe Illick, conductor. It's a New Year's Eve performance. Call 988-1234 for tickets Santa Fe to find out how much. It's going to be a fun show, New Year's Eve.
Fun indeed. The Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto.
That guy.
And Dvorak's New World Symphony. And we talked with Joe Illick about that on this show. And it was really interesting to me because he pointed out the different places in the New World Symphony where there are American spiritual, black spiritual influences and things like that. So you get to really listen to the influence of this continent on another composer.
That's pretty good. There you go, straight from the horse's mouth, even though she's more of a fox to me. And you're looking particularly foxy on New Year's Eve morning.
Ay, caramba.
A Tuna Christmas is running tonight over at the Santa Fe Playhouse, the popular sequel to Greater Tuna. Fun, goofy, two people, guys in drag. Who doesn't like it? 988-4262, and that continues through New Year's weekend at the Santa Fe Playhouse. Now, Light Up My Life, what do you know about that besides the song from, was that Debbie Boone?
Mm-hmm.
You light up my light. Remember we used to sing that when we were teenagers?
Not me.
I know you did.
I feel confident that you sang that song when you were a teenager. You know who did an amazing version of that on some kind of kids' variety show in the late 70s? Patti Smith.
Oh, I believe you. I think everybody should do a cover of that. Anyway, the 19th annual Light Up a Life is the lighting of Farolitos on the plaza tonight at 5:30 in memory of lost loved ones. You can purchase a Farolito for a price. Call Presbyterian Medical Services Foundation at 988-2211 because this event does benefit the hospice center. But it's a fun plaza event. Get down there at 5:30. It should be quiet. Should be safe. Might be cold.
Those are those matchboxes.
You got it.
And I made one of them.
Wow. You made one?
Yeah.
You made a matchbox?
Yeah.
You're kidding me. What is a matchbox anyway?
There are these long wooden boxes that hold those very long, thick wooden matches that you can use to light farolitos. In other words, a little match, you're going to burn your fingers if you're trying to light something which is a distance away.
Oh.
And so the Presbyterian Medical Services had this great idea to give all sorts of people, most of them more artistic than I am, a box, just a plain wooden box to decorate, and they had an opening at the Gerald Peters Gallery. And
well, that's right, the matchbox opening.
Yeah, they were beautiful. They were so impressive. And then they're all being auctioned off. It's a tremendous creative fundraiser.
When we were kids, we had matchbox cars. Do you remember those?
I do remember those.
Those were fun little cars, and you drove them around.
Also, were you small enough that you could get into one and drive it?
No, I was never that small. But I was more interested in like Barbie dolls and stuff because you could undress them.
Here we go.
Where are we going? We're not going anywhere. I'm just bringing this stuff up just to get us going here on the New Year's Eve. Okay, Studio 54, one more night party tonight. New Year's Eve dance party with DJ Una. Artemis, still in town, will host it.
Yay.
Drag show, 8:30. Silver Starlight Lounge, Rainbow Vision. Call 428-7777. Meanwhile, you got a New Year's Eve bash at Corazon with D Numbers and DJ Toast. Most of these you have to pay to get in. Cowgirl Barbecue has Stephanie Hatfield, who's just wonderful and so beautiful and soulful music. She's playing with Hot Mess. That's at 9 o'clock. The Corazon's at 9 o'clock. The La Casa Sena has a New Year's Eve Silver Anniversary Show. Piano and vocals, 6:30 and 9:30. That's Piano Bar. The Matador has DJ Inky. Inky Dinky Dink. Dinky 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 doo. Remember that song by Jimmy Durante? Mm-hmm. Oh, what a beautiful feeling. That's at 8:30 at the Matador. Down in the Madrid, if you go down there and you be careful driving, the Mineshaft Tavern has Joe West and Friends, which includes Mike the Can Man, Archie West, and Donna D. 8:30 p.m., cover charge. Quiet Night of Piano Music, David Geist over at Pronzo, 6 o'clock, small cover charge. Tiny's has the Jakes tonight at 8:30. No cover. And their Turquoise Trail Bar and Grill has Tequila Rain, dance variety at 9 o'clock, no cover. I'll also mention Second Street Brewery, the Bus Tapes.
Yay.
4:30, early show, and later on the night is Terra East Sound System. The Second Street Brewery in the Rail Yard is supposed to open around New Year's.
Yes, and we're going to be doing a show on beer.
When?
Soon.
You have to invite me. I drink beer all the time. I start drinking beer when I was 11 a.m.
Yeah, well, we're going to do a whole show covering the history of beer and the...
Oh, man.
Beer and its multiform and myriad manifestations.
Did people ever take baths in beer like Jane Mansfield did in Pink Champagne?
You know, I might not be the best person to answer that question.
Can you ask those guys when you have them on?
Sure.
Because remember when she used to take baths in champagne?
No, I don't. Can you say more about that?
Well, Jane Mansfield was like this incredibly vivacious bombshell from the 50s. Some people thought she was trying to be Marilyn Monroe, but I think she was just trying to be herself. And she had, she liked pink and she liked heart-shaped things, and she used to take baths in champagne. So I don't know why I'm telling the story, but I always wondered what she would like smell like after that.
She might smell rather like champagne.
I guessed. Well, she could burst my cork open, let me tell you, taking a look at that dame. Okay, tomorrow's the 1st. It's January 1st. Most people are off.
So have you basically said every...
Just about every. There's other events, New Year's Eve events. I can't get them all in, but there's quite a few. And just check it out. And again, be careful. Remember the Tipsy Toe, AAA, and remember the Santa Fe County DWI Caddy program. These things can get you home. And again, look at last Friday's Pasta Tiempo, which was our holiday writing contest, and a lot of people really liked that issue.
Did you mention that Savor is going to be playing at the Inn of the Anasazi?
I did not mention Savor.
In case you need to dance to Cuban music on New Year's Eve.
Savor.
It's from 9 o'clock until 1 in the morning.
Cover charge?
No doubt.
Okay. We don't mention that on KSFR. You're a wonderful, beautiful, going into 2010 radio.
But I'm looking at their calendar,
station.
And it doesn't say what the cover charge is. But
okay.
Anyway.
So tomorrow's the 1st. There are a few gallery openings. If you head up Canyon Road, Gallery 822 has a New Year's Day miniature show. My head usually feels like a miniature when I wake up on New Year's Day. Manitou Galleries on Palace has work from the 2010 Manitou Galleries calendar. That's receptions at 5. And the Brandon Michael... Fine Art on 202 Canyon Road has The Figure. Ooh, I like that. Group show. Reception 5 to 7. So there are a few shows happening tomorrow, New Year's Day. And Guitar Shorties at Corazon tomorrow night, 10 p.m. So that should be fun. Tuna Christmas, as I mentioned, continues. And there are a lot of New Year weekend music events. And next week is one of the quietest weeks in arts in town. I know this from being at Pasta Tiempo and being here since like 1992. It's a great time to either go check out some music at night or go to some of your museums in town and call for your museum hours. Yeah, you have
Absolutely.
Something to say?
Well, I got a note from Mike Rude that the Mike Rude Trio is live at Vanessi's on January 2nd, so the day after New Year's, from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. Guitar, bass, and drum, original contemporary jazz from New York City, influenced by Brazilian classical folk and Latin music.
Wow.
MikeRood.com, R-O-O-D.
Nice. So let me plug some museums. And remember, call for holiday hours. I'm guessing they're all closed on New Year's Day. But the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture up on Camino Lejo still has this weekend Native American Picture Books of Change, which is an exhibit of historic drawings. The Museum of International Folk Art up there in the hill has Material Worlds. We're living in a material world. Textiles and Dress from the Collection. Reception show runs through May of, I think, 2011, actually. They still have the Shadow Puppets up there, Dancing Shadows, Epic Tales.
Indonesian Shadow Puppets. Oh, good. I'm glad that's still going on.
And then New Mexico History Museum downtown near Palace of the Governors has... Santa Fe Found, Fragments of Time, Telling New Mexico, Stories from Then and Now, and Treasures of Devotion. There's a lot of things happening down there. New Mexico Museum of Art downtown. You've got the Museum of Contemporary Native Arts down in Cathedral Place. You've got the O'Keeffe Museum on Johnson Street. You've got the Site Santa Fe, Wheelwright Museum. They're all having things happen. You can go by there. Call for information. Call this. Find out the holiday schedule. But this next week or two is a good time to go. And I'm pretty sure New Mexico residents free on Sundays to the museums.
I believe so. And it's also, I mean, a lot of people have friends and family in from out of town. And it's a great place to take them to those places
and
that you should
there.
Be going yourself because you live here and it's a wonderful opportunity. And we forget because we take them for granted. But then you take your, you know, your relatives and friends who are visiting.
Drop
to
them
go
off.
See the museums. No, you go
come
yourself.
Come meet me for beer. Moscow Festival Ballet is in this week. They'll be performing at the Lenzik on Monday and Tuesday night.
Wow.
Including that guy Tchaikovsky, his Sleeping Beauty.
Mm.
Was that one of your favorite stories as a little girl?
I liked a lot of those fairy tales, actually.
Okay, so
I don't know if that was my favorite.
Okay.
There's so many versions of it. You know, everyone thinks of those goofy little dwarves, but I think I've mentioned this to you before, but my mother always, she wouldn't let me read the Disney or see the Disney cartoon versions of things like that. I had to read the Grimm's fairy tale version.
Get your information right here. The Sleeping Beauty didn't have the seven dwarfs.
Oh, that's Snow White.
That was seven dwarfs for seven brothers. You're mixing up metaphors and analogies, and you're sleeping.
Snow White and sleep.
That's right. Snow White was like her cousin. They hung out with Little Red Riding Hood. They used to get together and have a sewing circle. And we'll go more into detail about that for you adults out there.
I don't remember.
And then Goldilocks was the blonde of the troop. She was the one that, you know, Jason and the Golden Fleece and the Argonauts and all that, they got tied up with that.
Which was the one who fell asleep for a long time?
That was Rip Van Winkle. He was in another story.
No, I mean, was Snow White?
Sleeping Beauty went to sleep but didn't age.
Snow White?
She went to sleep because the witch gave her the apple and she almost died, and then dwarfs chased her off the edge, and then the prince kissed her. The prince is always kissing these women and reviving them, and you know what that's all about.
So Sleeping Beauty was Dorian Gray.
I don't know what the dame's name was. I never got that close to her. I didn't look at her mailbox. How do I know if her name was Dorian? She was, she didn't grow old or anything. She was just a beautiful... Okay, once upon a time there was a Sleeping Beauty. She was a nice dame. She got some evil princess mad at her. She put her to sleep. The prince had to go fight the dragon, and then he went and kissed her, and she came back to life. The seven dwarfs moved in. They hired Goldilocks as the one to clean the place up. She showed up. The three bears moved in, except two of them were a little too bare for the kids to see, so they had to move it over to the adult theater. That's where I caught the show. And then I won't go into Pinocchio because the things that happened with his nose and those two female burlesque dancers was obscene. So
Robert,
that's the whole thing. What?
The end. That's like, you know what that's like? That was like Shakespeare abridged. Every Shakespeare play condensed into an hour.
Well, and we won't even talk about Rasputin and Rapunzel and Rumpelstiltskin, those guys.
The three R's.
Right. So what else?
It's a good thing this is the end of the year, because we can put all this behind us and open up to a new year in which the milk of human kindness flows.
Here we go. Every year you and me start over again with this. We have great milk of human kindness for each other. Just goes sour once in a while. Thursday. Is Thursday night the live HD broadcast of A Prairie Home Companion? Have you heard about that at the Lenzik?
Excellent.
I think that's Thursday night if you look fans of the Garrison Keillor program. 6 o'clock at the Lenzik, 988-1234.
Garrison Keillor is brilliant.
He is brilliant. He's terrific and wonderful.
He emceed Merce Cunningham's 77th birthday, which was a huge event in New York. And Merce Cunningham, of all the people in the world that he could have chosen, chose Garrison Keillor.
Who would you have to emcee your 77th?
Should I live that long?
Well, I know we're talking about 40 years away.
Yeah. I don't know. Haven't thought about it. How about you?
If I'm still doing the show.
I think Robert Knott would be the one that I would choose.
There we go. How are we doing for time?
We got 2 minutes left.
Okay. There is an all-ages informal swing dance Monday night at Oddfellows Hall. Lessons 7 to 8, dance 8 to 10:30, small fee to get in. There's also the Cowgirl Karaoke that night at the Cowgirl Barbecue on Guadalupe Street. There's the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Art and Leadership Program for Women. A workshop by Sherry Mann, Tips to Accomplish Your Dreams. That's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, I believe. Call 946-1007 to find out if that's correct. And on Wednesday, the Santa Fe Council on International Relations is going to have a World Affairs Discussion Luncheon at 11:30 at the Santa Fe Hilton. You got to pay to get in, but you get fed. 982-4931.
And so, Robert, what are you doing on New Year's Eve?
What are you doing New Year's? I'm going to go and see if the Jane Mansfield Film Festival is on TV. If it is, I'll watch some of those things like The Girl Can't Help It and Will Success by Rock Hunter. She also did a Hercules movie where she has a skinny dipping scene.
Not going to go out?
I don't go out on New Year's Eve.
Ah. Well, then you won't have to have your car towed home.
That doesn't mean I want him the way I drive. My car is always getting towed home. And I'm going to have a relaxing weekend. I'm not going to have to go to work, which is amazing. And then I'm going to look forward to a new year with a whole bunch of new things occurring. And hopefully unemployment is not one of those things. But if so, I'll survive. And what about you? What's your New Year's resolution?
You know...
To kiss me? Thank you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Whew, got out of that one. Robert Knott is the associate editor of the Pasatiempo Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe,
nice.
New Mexican.
That let's try this.
You were just... Stop it. And he's with us here every Friday and occasional Thursdays if it's New Year's Eve. Speaking of the arts.
Ooh.
And thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. How could I be kissing you when you were talking? Ah, the glory of sound effects in the radio.
What?
I'll see you next Friday.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
I know
my
that.
Name is Mary Charlotte.
Oh, I know
we're
that too.
Streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, good morning, jazz. Happy New Year!
Good morning, jazz. Happy New Year.
Hey, hasta la vista.
And Happy New Year, lady.
Ciao.
Thank you.